This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK10. And also by Zoe, the world's first personal voice companion, enabling Star Trek combadge-like interactions with Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, smart objects, and much, much more. To find out more about Zoe, visit xowi.me/trekfm. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 117, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Ben McCormick. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including what Harrison Ford might be doing in the next Trek film, the poll results of which character should have died differently, and we offer up recommendations for Halloween Star Trek viewing. Then in the feature, we're joined by Mike Schindler and Max Hegel to discuss the DS9 episode, For the Uniform. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Ben. It's great to have you back on the Ready Room. It's been a while. I've been trying to catch you forever, and you've been like the globetrotter or the country trotter, whatever you want to call it, some traveling that's been going on. So it's good to have you back on and first time doing news with me.
Yeah, it's really great. I come back into the country after a nice little overseas trip, and I get to be on the big part of the show. So it's kind of a new thing for me.
What were you doing on that trip where I kept asking you if you're available? And I'm still traveling.
Still on travel. Nope, just doing some computer work, that's all. You know, keeping the Cardassians out of the plasma inducers.
So. Okay. You were setting up the holographic projectors, the holographic communicators at the UN probably, right?
Well, some of the field offices, you know, out in CENTCOM and the Fifth Fleet area, I had to go ship to ship and put that nice little ring on the bridge and explain that you can't walk inside of the ring.
Right. Make sure, like, if you're too tall, you have to crouch a little bit so your head won't be cut off.
Yeah. Right, right. It's real disturbing where somebody's watching it and all they see is, like, the headless horseman on the bridge talking to them.
Exactly. I can't see his mouth. Oh, well, you know, that actually, headless horseman, that is a great thing because it leads us into the first thing we're going to talk about today. It's kind of a light news week for Star Trek. So we're going to talk about a couple of things here that aren't really news items per se, but with this Thursday being Halloween, I thought it would be fun to talk about Spook Treks, some of our favorite spooky or scary episodes. Now, I don't think there was ever an actual Headless Horseman episode of Star Trek, but there were certainly others that were, you know, based on some classic tales of spookiness. And, you know, I have some of my favorites, but why don't you tell me first, Ben, what's one of your favorite spooky episodes of Star Trek?
Well, one of my favorite spooky episodes is actually one of my earliest Star Trek memories, and it was Cat's Paw.
Yeah, that's the classic, right?
That episode, it had to have been the Halloween episode that year.
It was, yeah.
I mean, it was written just, I don't know, every little Halloween-type mythos tried to fit in there with the scary castle and, you know. To this day, I'm terrified of cats, though. Yeah, I think it goes back to the childhood trauma of this episode.
Well, I have a solution for you. What you do is just think about Isis from Assignment Earth, not in cat form, and then you won't be scared of cats anymore.
Which is funny because that was the actual first episode of Star Trek that I ever watched. So,
really?
It was. Wow. And so I had the good cat, bad cat experience at a young age.
Well, Cat's Paw actually aired on October 27th, so I do think it is the only time in Star Trek where Star Trek actually did have a Halloween episode.
Mm-hmm.
So that this is one that I always have to watch this on Halloween every year. It's one of my personal traditions, a Cat's Paw. Besides the obvious, the smoke, which is especially well done in the remastered version, the castle, all the spookiness, the dungeon with the skeletons. There's one really, really frightening thing in here, and that's Chekhov's hair.
He was still in the wig at this time, right? That was the...
He was. And if I remember correctly, now it wasn't the first episode. If you watch them in production order, it's not the first episode, but I believe this is the first episode that we actually saw Chekhov in terms of the order that they were broadcast originally. So seeing that hair on him was just like, what are you guys doing?
It was a new experience for America. But at the I mean, consider the time, though. The monkeys were big, so maybe that's, it wasn't as terrifying, you know, during that
probably
time.
Yeah.
Everyone, they wrote this for future generations.
That's right. That's right. Well, sticking with the TOS while we're there, another one that is pretty spooky is The Enemy Within, Richard Matheson's contribution to the original series, and that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde situation, because, you know, the evil Kirk, he's pretty out there. You could see him as the villain in any, you know, Halloween horror movie.
But my big question from that episode, though, was why does Kirk keep makeup in his wardrobe? I mean, was that right, like a past lover that had left it there or something? But, or is the captain kind of that vain that, you know, he keeps a little foundation there just in case?
Just in case. I mean, you never know when a girl's going to need to touch up before going back on duty.
And I mean, we know that Spock keeps the eyeshadow, I mean, well stocked in his quarters, but
that's right.
This is the first proof that in the future, makeup, you know, just go as necessary.
So this is a good one to watch on Halloween as well. Of course, Richard mm-hmm. Matheson was well known for being more on the horror side of the genre than anything else. So excellent episode there. What else do you recommend for people to watch to get into that Halloween spirit?
Well, I mean, you know, going off of some of the since we're still on TOS, I think Wolf in the Fold, I mean, was definitely the whole Red Jack thing, you know, in the possession. Yeah. That was a nice little tie-in. And the fact that it ties into Jack the Ripper.
That's, yeah, for me, the thing.
You know, so that was a really cool, for me, you know, watching it, you know, the way it just, this has been the serial killer throughout generations. And it was in line with Star Trek, though, I mean, that we see later as well for some of the listeners who you know, may have come to us from The Next Generation or later episodes. You know, there were episodes of Next Generation that had the ancient ghost, I think, like, was it Beverly's grandmother?
Yeah, Sub Rosa.
Who had her personal
yeah.
ghost. Yeah, Sub Rosa. And so this is right in line with that, except of a more, you know, scary nature.
A scary nature, yeah. Well, it was written by Robert Block, who wrote Psycho, so that tells you something about the story. Fans love to hate Sub Rosa, but it is a good... I mean, if you're looking for a ghost story, you know, if you're looking for Star Trek episodes for Halloween...
But see, that's more, for me, not so spooky, as it's kind of like a Harlequin romance ghost story. You know, it's... You know, it has the ghost elements, and for some reason, you know, castles and the moors and things like that are your Halloween, you know, motif. But that one for me wasn't so much scary as maybe a creepy factor.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ben, like me, you grew up in Alabama. When you were in middle school, did you go to the school library and check out the 13 Alabama Ghosts books?
Yes.
And read those kind of stories?
Yes, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
And on the campus at Alabama, we have all these stories about the different buildings that are supposedly haunted. There's, mm-hmm. I think it's, gosh, I graduated 20-something years ago, but if I can remember correctly, I think it's Smith Hall, which is, if you're facing the back of the Gorgas Library, to the left, there's Smith Hall, is supposed to be haunted. And the story is supposedly that if you're there at the right time of night and look up, you can see the ghost standing in the window looking out. Mm. So it's kind of like that kind of ghost story, right?
Right, right. And I think from the 13 Ghost book, I forget exactly the details, but there's the one where lightning struck and it locked the face of the I think it was a young lady who was going to be killed or something, as she looked out into the crowd. And so now on stormy nights, you can see her face looking out at you from the window.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the fun stories. Sub Rosa reminds me of those kinds of stories a little bit more, as opposed you know, the Psycho. Now, what do you think about this one? This is really creepy. Now, Larry has mentioned before here on the show that Brandon Braga became known around the staff as the weird shit guy. Those are Larry's words. Schisms. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about watching Schisms on Halloween night?
I probably wouldn't watch it on Halloween night because that is a pretty scary episode. You know, it. How do you do an alien abduction episode in a sci-fi show?
Where there are aliens all around you anyway, right?
Yeah. I mean, how do you
all the time?
Every abduction would be an alien abduction, but this, you know, opened that up. And so you have the crew who are, you know, for the most of the episode, it's they're powerless to help themselves, which is an unusual feeling for, you know, the crew of the Enterprise, that sense of helplessness.
Yeah.
And it was really scary. I mean, especially with the different experimentations and stuff that were going on, and the tools they were using were really just scary looking.
Yeah, yeah. It really was. And later on Voyager, Scientific Method reminds me somewhat of Schisms, where you do have these aliens who, in this case, are on the ship and they're doing all these experiments on people, but people can't see the stuff. But it didn't have the same feeling for me as Schisms.
Right.
Scientific Method was just more of an interesting concept. Schisms is really creepy.
Yeah, I got to remember, I mean, you know, I was older when Schisms came on, but I mean, it was, years later with the Voyager episodes, but Schisms still, yeah, that ranks right up there maybe I'll watch that early afternoon now, but, you know, so there's still some sunlight left in the day, so I can have, maybe I'll watch a funny episode after Schisms, so, you know, it doesn't taint my dreams too badly.
Yeah, otherwise you wake up hearing clicking noises everywhere.
Jeez, yeah, thanks. We're recording this kind of late for me, so.
That's true.
Thanks.
All right. Well, what else do you recommend for Halloween night?
One of the ones that, you know, comes to mind, that's not really, again, it's not one of the scary episodes, but it's definitely one of the suspense episodes that I think, Frame of Mind, because that one really, I don't know. It's just that it's almost Hitchcockian level of it, where is he crazy? Is he not? You know, it was a very well played episode, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's another one of Brandon Braga's weird stories, but.
And it does have one of the only mentions of my favorite starship in Next Generation, the Yorktown.
The Yorktown. And not the Malinche.
Not the Malinche. No. The Malinche has too many troubles.
Well, you know, DS9 doesn't have as many episodes that I can put on the list as spooky ones for Halloween, but I guess if there is one, it would be Impok Nor, which is very much like being in a haunted house.
Mm-hmm. The abandoned station just has that, because it's familiar, but then it's wrong. It's completely unfamiliar at the same time, you know, which was a great way to reuse sets, I guess, but with it being the same class as Terraknor.
Yeah. Right.
But it was definitely, that was the haunted house episode, if there was one.
And there are those people on Impok Nor, they're like drug induced and they're attacking the crew, and then Garak falls under that spell. So it's a very spooky
mm-hmm.
episode. So for Niners, there's your Halloween viewing. Another episode that I like and a lot of fans don't like, which is really creepy from Voyager, is The Thaw, where you actually have Lenny from Laverne and Shirley being mm-hmm. a crazy clown.
Yeah, that was a really hard episode for me to get into. And it's funny that you refer to him as Lenny from Laverne and Shirley because he's been on so many other things.
Right. But for me, he'll always be Lenny from Laverne and Shirley.
Without fail, every time I try, if I see him in another show and I'm telling someone about the show, even when he appeared as Perry White on Smallville, uh-huh. I was telling someone about it. I said, well, it was Lenny from Laverne and Shirley. Lenny was Perry White now. What? Even Spinal Tap. Oh, yeah, Lenny. He was in Spinal Tap, too.
You know, Penny Marshall. I thought she was a director. Well, yeah, she is now, but...
No, this was before that.
That's before that. So, the first time I saw the episode, I did have trouble kind of getting into it as well. But as I've rewatched mm-hmm. it a number of times, I actually think it's a very interesting episode. That idea of literally being scared to death and the clown being this personification of kind of of fear mm-hmm. and the psychotic nature of our mind that, you know, can manifest itself under certain circumstances. So it's actually one of Voyager's better episodes, in my opinion, although most fans will disagree with me.
And is that fans of Star Trek or fans of Voyager?
Fans of Voyager, even, yeah.
Ah, wow.
I think so, yeah. At least that's been my experience. If you want a good old-fashioned sit-around-the-campfire ghost story from Voyager, though, there's always The Haunting of Deck 12.
Oh, yeah, wow. I forgot about that one. That's,
what was it? It's got everything, Ben. It's got Neelix. It's got the Borg children.
Well, see, you've already made it a scary episode. Neelix is featured, so.
It's just, you know, Neelix. What happens? The power's down on the ship, and Neelix has to take care of the Borg children. He has a plasma lantern, and they all sit down, and he tells them the story about a ghost that is said to live on deck 12. So mm-hmm. it is kind of like that. You're out camping, sitting around the campfire, only it's a plasma lantern, and just tell a good old ghost story. What else do you have that you recommend for Star Trek fans?
Well,
anything else from Voyager, Enterprise?
Well, Enterprise, one of the creepiest scenes, I think, for all of Star Trek for me was from Fight or Flight.
Yeah, that was creepy.
When they find the bodies, you know, it was, you know, Star Trek 2 kind of had the whole hanging bodies thing, but Fight or Flight, it was just really, wow. And I kind of put myself in, Hoshi? This was Hoshi, like one of her first way team missions.
Yeah.
Or, you know, going aboard. And then for that to be what you find, you know, just bodies from the ceiling and all the different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she's so uncomfortable with being on the ship in the first place. And then when mm-hmm. they beam over there, she's like, okay, I'll go. And they beam over there. And it is like an old haunted house where it's dark and you turn around and there are all these bodies hanging upside down with tubes coming out of them.
Right.
And that would be really freaky. And I thought that was a really good episode at the beginning of Enterprise because it really highlighted the crew not expecting to find things like that out there in space and then having to deal with the realities of being out there.
It just really highlighted how unprepared they were. I mean, that this was humanity's first stumbling steps into interstellar space.
Yeah.
And we really weren't ready for it. I mean, you know, the ship wasn't really heavily armed. We didn't even have shields yet. And then you're coming across stuff like this. And this was the one with the giant alien ship that shows up at the end, isn't it?
Who comes because they think that the Enterprise crew is responsible for for draining the fluids out of the bodies. Yeah. Yeah. Now,
really creepy.
Speaking of ships, another one that's creepy but in a very interesting way is Dead Stop, where the ship's damaged and they pull into that station that's all automated mm-hmm. and it's going to repair the ship in exchange for, I think it's warp plasma that they give them. And
right.
But it's also like, we did this episode on here, and we called it Automated Customer Service from Hell, because you can't talk to anybody, right? It's just this computer, and Archer starts getting fed up with it. But it turns out that they actually are kidnapping people, and they kidnap Travis and put him in this room. It's like, you deal with computers, right, Ben? Do you have a room where you've got like bodies racked up, like rack systems that are usually computers, but they're bodies and you're using their brains to power the network?
We haven't gotten that upgrade yet, but we're looking for some volunteers. So, you know, we're hoping, you know, one of our ships will come in and we can just get like a mannequin and replace one of their crewmen with it and they won't notice. Okay.
So, I was thinking like an auto repair shop, but where you kidnap one of the occupants and you take them out back and you put them in the rack system, because that's basically what's happening here in that stuff.
It's and poor Mayweather. I mean, this, you know, was pretty early on that he was kind of identified. What was it during the original series movies? They were, you know, Chekhov screams and Chekhov screams again. You know, he was the one who got, he was the punishment.
Yeah.
And then in Next Generation, I think Geordi took a lot of punishment.
Geordi did. And then, of course, Miles on DS9 gets tortured all the time. That was a running gag with the writers. Yeah. And then you've got Harry Kim, who gets killed many times in Voyager.
A few times. So Mayweather was on his way with this episode to being the torture victim of the day.
Yeah. So, and do you like zombies?
You know, that's pretty much my big try to avoid a Halloween, because they really creep me out.
So you probably don't want to watch Impulse then on Halloween, do you?
You know, the couple of times that I've seen it, that's pretty much been enough. I mean, Vulcan zombies, that's a pretty big thing.
Because they're really strong, right? They're much stronger than normal zombies, right. I mean, think.
And I got to imagine, though, that, you know, human zombies are pretty strong. You know, they're breaking down doors and stuff all the time. Vulcan zombies, you really don't want to mess with, because, you know, they're stronger, faster, they can hear better. Well, I guess if zombies can hear, which they're attracted to sound, if you watch The Walking Dead.
Yeah. But well, and they're, you know, if you're human, they're going to smell you really easily, because humans smell bad to Vulcans. So.
Humans smell bad. We were just talking about that today, and I was trying to explain why, you know, Vulcans have a higher sense of smell than we do. So this would really be a danger. They'd really be able to find us. And if you're scared, you're going to sweat, and thus you'll smell even worse. So there's no chance for you on that one.
And I wonder what happens if you mind meld with the undead.
Ooh. Well, it takes a whole new level to the brains motif of zombies. You know?
I'll have your brains, and then they stick their hand on your head.
Well, maybe that's what they're seeking, is instead of the, you know, these being Vulcan zombies, instead of trying to bite you and get to your brains, they just want a really good mind meld. And
that's what they want.
You know,
yeah.
Seek that out.
I wonder if they missed an opportunity in Spock's brain of having like a Starfleet zombie crew go to retrieve Spock's brain.
Brain!
Well,
I missed a lot of opportunities with that episode, actually.
That's a fun episode. We had fun doing that. Actually, Jenny was on with us, I think.
That's right. Yeah.
Spock's brain on here. So, well, I have one last one, Ben, myself, and that is Vanishing Point from Enterprise, because it's a creepy story as well. That's where Hoshi thinks that she's disappearing, because they beam up from the storm and she thinks that she's vanishing. And that's where they have the whole story of Cyrus Ramsey, which you may have noticed my screen name right now is Cyrus Ramsey. Mm-hmm. The Starfleet officer whose molecules got scattered in a transporter accident in the early days of transporter technology, and no one ever heard from him again. And it's just a really fun, spooky episode.
You know, it's kind of neat to see that, though, you know, in the 24th century, or in Enterprise's case, you know, the 22nd, that in the future, the same basic scary things would still, you know, exist as scary, just modified. You know, now there's, you know, instead of ghosts, you know, this is a more literate scientific society. but they're explainable ghosts. Oh, you know, through if it was a transporter accident, or if they're affected by the area of space you're in, or, you know, I can imagine some technobabble that they would come up with. Oh, he was an interphasic being at that point, and he was able to go through walls. Ooh, you know. Just the kind of tales that you would tell around the campfire or the replicator.
Yeah, they stay same. It's just the how they become ghosts that changes a little bit. Very
spooky,
well.
Spooky, scary.
Well, there is a good list of episodes for everyone to watch, no matter what series you enjoy, to watch on Halloween night. I'll be watching Cat's Paw myself for sure, because as I said, that's my tradition. And I might try to watch a few of these others if I can squeeze them in. So, Ben, while we're talking about ghosts and, I guess, people who have died, and we think they've died, that leads us to another topic here. And this was the StarTrek.com poll that was out this past week that asked which character should have died differently. And you were telling me in the other side of the room...
The other side of the room.
...that you actually participated in this poll.
Yes.
So, who did you vote for?
I think, and I disagree with some of the results that came out, but I voted that Kirk should have died differently than he did. For someone of his stature, you know, the years of history, you know, just there should have been a better death episode. But
there really wasn't. I mean, people blame Ronald D. Moore and Brandon Braga for killing Kirk, right, in Generations. Although Kirk was already dead, and then... they killed him again because the Nexus brought him back, I guess, right?
Right.
It's kind of confusing. I mean, it wasn't exactly, you know, as far as history was concerned, he died saving the people on the transports when the Enterprise B was trying to rescue them, which, I mean, I don't think there's anything that you could do as a death scene for Kirk that's going to satisfy us because the character is so much bigger than life. But if you think about a Starfleet officer sacrificing yourself to save a ship, especially a ship named Enterprise, and to save the people, civilians on that transport, I mean, I think that's a noble death for a Starfleet officer.
That would, if that was his only death, I would be happy with that.
Yeah.
But it's just, then you have the entire thing with the Nexus and coming back. And I had some problems with that. Yeah.
I can agree on that. So, but Kirk did not finish first in this poll. Kirk actually finished second with 20% of the vote. Tasha Yar finished first with 26% of the vote. Now, do you have a problem with her winning the poll?
You know, given the choice, if I couldn't pick Kirk, I don't think I would have picked her because I think her death was really... I don't want to say diminished, but it didn't have as much impact, you know, when you watch the whole of Next Generation and you see her come back as the alternate time.
And we didn't know her very well because it's first season and we haven't spent enough time with her to really get attached to her.
Right, right. The one that I really thought should have been higher on the list, though, was Trip.
Yeah.
Because that... And I'm one of the many fans who just say that episode didn't happen.
Yeah.
That was a holodeck episode, a lost episode of TNG.
Right.
Had nothing to do with Enterprise, the series.
Yeah, I don't consider that to be an Enterprise episode either. Certainly, it's not the finale of Enterprise. It's just the last episode that aired. I mean, the fact that it came on the same night as Demons, you know, it was back-to-back. And as they've said, that was their Valentine to Star Trek. But yeah, Trip, I mean, the way they killed him was completely pointless. There was no reason. It was completely out of character, what he did. It made no sense at all. And thankfully, spoiler alert, in the novels, they brought him back. And because, hey, that episode never happened, right? So Trip got 18% of the vote in this poll, which was tied for third with Jadzia. And Jadzia, now this is a character who we were very attached to when she died, unlike Tasha. Jadzia's death, I'm kind of mixed on it because I don't like the fact that they killed off a character just because they couldn't sign her for one more season and Terry Farrell wanted off the show, and so they killed her. I never like it when they kill a character for that reason. But at least they did. She did die in a way that it tied into the story, although it was still meaningless to me. Like, it didn't have to happen. So it's not as egregious as what they did to Trip, but I still wasn't happy with the death. I think I would have rather her have died, let's say, in Change of Heart or something, where it seems like she's going to die and, you know, Worf is there. And if she had actually died then, that would have meant something to me, you know, as a character story, more so than what happened to her. Data rounded off the poll with 17%. And I really didn't have a problem with Data's death and Nemesis. I did have a problem with B4. I think that they completely ruined Data's death by having B4 in the ready room with Picard at the end. But as far as Data himself goes, and I've heard Brent Spiner insisted that Data die in Nemesis. Mm-hmm. That's I think actually I've heard Rick Berman say that before, if I remember correctly. But I didn't have a I thought it was kind of the end of his journey. You know, he wanted to be human and he sacrificed himself at the end.
And that's the ultimate human thing to do, is to sacrifice yourself for your crew and your friends. But I do agree, though, that the B4 thing really lessened it. It would be almost like in Star Trek II, if Carol Marcus, during the presentation that Kirk, Spock, and McCoy watch about the Genesis Project, if during that process she says, oh, and if you approve this and we test it, if you ever shoot a freshly dead body toward the planet, there's a good chance that they'll regenerate back to life. So just keep that in mind if you approve this Genesis Project. And then at the end of the movie, that's what happens. And it would have really, it's like, oh, well, he's coming back.
I mean, all you need to do is just download that person's memory into someone else's head temporarily, and then you can transfer it back. Because that's what they're doing with B4, right?
Right. I mean, it's just they made a good backup of Data, and now you got to restore the back. You know, some guys in the server room is like, yeah, do you got the data tapes for, data tapes? For Thursday. Oh yeah, we did a full backup, and here's the two incrementals. Yep. So he'll lose about a day or two of memory, but we got him.
Unfortunately, that day, the IT manager on duty was Pulaski, and she said, "No, we have the data tapes, but not the data tapes. Sorry, can't help you."
And so they just left it on the shelf.
But the explanation with Data that here's before he physically is a duplicate of Data. Mm-hmm. And Data is a machine, and so yes, you can download his memory core and you can put it into another body. Yes, it makes sense. I mean, technically, yes, they can do that. I just think that it diminishes the character, and it diminishes the entire 7 years of The Next Generation and those four films and his journey to become more human, to at the end say that he's gone, but we can just transfer everything into this new body.
Yeah.
So I wasn't happy about that. No. So I don't know, for me on this list, if I were going to rank them first, it would probably be Trip, and then Jadzia, and then Kirk, Yar, Data, probably. Just because Yar, it was completely meaningless. It was horribly written, but I wasn't attached to the character when it happened.
The only plus I saw with Yar's death was that, you know, this was a quasi-military service with Starfleet. You know, there are inherent risks in being out there. And sometimes people die for stupid reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like that was a completely wasted death. And you know, it was a shame to see it happen. But sometimes that happens. And that's, you know, I would think that would be part of Starfleet. But, I mean, just think of all the poor crewmen who walked in front of the plants for Kirk on the planets, and hey, Captain, this plant's really got dead red shirt. I mean, meaningless deaths. This is the first time we had a main character get red shirted.
That's the thing, that it's a main character, because even on TNG, I mean, it happens, right? Like Jeremy Astor's mother gets killed. In Line of Duty, it happens. It just doesn't happen to the main characters,
right?
And they address it. So, all right. Well, it was an interesting poll. They've had some interesting poll results recently. And also in recent polls, the long-running continuous winning streak of Voyager in StarTrek.com polls seems to have been broken, because we're getting a little bit more diversity in the poll results these days, which is good to see. Mm-hmm. Well, Ben, let's take a break from news for a minute to talk about our new sponsor, which we introduced last week, and that's Zoe, the world's first personal voice companion. And interestingly, this is very much like it's the beginning of the Star Trek comm badge. And Ben, you were in the military. Would you have liked to have had a little badge like this with you when you were in the military to communicate?
I can see how it'd be very handy. We always joked about having communicators and how handy it would be, and just to be able to interface with a computer like that. And now that we're actually apparently getting there, I mean, this is, we live in the future, I guess.
Yeah, it is really cool. And of course, we have things like Siri today that help us do some communications. But what Zoe is doing is really interesting, because it really moves beyond that. And there are a lot of real world benefits to this device, which you'll see if you go over and you check out their information, helping people who maybe have difficulty with certain tasks. It's a great way. Voice communication is wonderful. And it has similarities to the types of Bluetooth devices that we're starting to see as companions to smartphones. Of course, we're seeing smartwatches coming around. We're seeing things like Google Glass coming around. That's all on your wrist and on your face. But what Zoe does is it really opens it up Star Trek style, to where you're not having to look down at your arm or wear something on your face in order to have these interactions. It's just a very small badge that you can wear. And you can give it commands like, turn off the air conditioner, give me traffic conditions, turn on the porch lights, read my Twitter messages, or in the case of what we're going to talk about in the feature today, play Les Miserables. You can get your Valjean, get your Javert on to get ready to watch for the uniform. And it enables person-to-person connection without phone calls. And it also enables self-service interactions with things like Twitter and Facebook and Spotify. And very importantly, because, there's the people use iPhones, people use Android phones, people use Windows phones, Zoe's very open. They have voice modules that are extensible, so third-party developers can tie in anything they want to Zoe by using these voice modules. So the capabilities of this device really will expand regardless of what platform you personally use. It comes with a companion app for Android, for iOS, for BlackBerry, for a Windows phone. And it's under development right now. And last week we mentioned that they were going to be starting a Kickstarter campaign. They've actually launched the campaign a little bit ahead of schedule, and it is blazing already. In just a few days, they've already raised $13,848 on their way to their goal of $100,000 to further the development. So a lot of people are clearly eager to get their hands on this Star Trek comm badge type technology. There are 7 different incentive levels in the Kickstarter campaign right now, ranging from $5 to $10,000 or more. However you want to contribute, you can, and you can get things ranging from t-shirts all the way up to an actual seat on the advisory board. And Zoe will actually fly you out to Washington, all expenses paid, for the advisory board meeting when that takes place, if you buy into that top level. And also, when you contribute to the Zoe project, you'll be able to reserve your own Zoe device for a special price of just $149. So this is a really amazing device. I'm really excited about it myself. And you can see all the details on the new Kickstarter page. The best way to get there is to go to zoe.me/trekafilm. That's xowi.me/trekafilm, and that'll take you right over there. They have a lot of new images, a lot of new videos, new information showing exactly how Zoe works and how it benefits people in their everyday lives. And go check it out and contribute to the campaign and make this a reality. And be sure to include the Trek FM portion of the URL when you visit, so that Zoe knows that you heard about it here on Trek FM. All right, Ben. Well, hopefully we'll both be wearing Zoe's, a year or so from now, and communicating with things. And I think they'll be the perfect accessory for our uniforms. And as today we're going to talk about for the uniform, I thought it would be fun to talk about this infographic that I found over on Design Taxi. It is a guide to Star Trek uniforms. It was another piece of artwork that was done to show all of the different uniform styles that have been worn through the different generations of Star Trek. And you told me that there was one thing on here, I think, that bugged you a little bit. But what did you think about this overall?
The infographic looked really great. I liked the style that they used. But they had the one problem that I've always seen with Trek uniforms is the Star Trek II uniforms, which are always my favorite. But they show the three colors that they show with operations, the cadets and junior officers, and command division. But there was a third color that was kind of a light blue gray color that Uhura wore. And they've never really nailed down what that division was. Was it communications? Was it, you know, some people were saying it was like they combined computer sciences with sciences. They leave out medical, which was the green color that McCoy wore. And only because I believe the gentleman's name was Foster that designed the Star Trek II uniforms had came out with a full sweeping guide to the uniforms, the rank insignia and everything. Right. But again, overall, though, this infographic, I mean, to squeeze in as much data as they're doing, I mean, I think it's great. I sat here before the show just scrolling up and down, and it was kind of cool to see the evolution over the years of the uniforms that as they, you know, went from Next Generation time frame into the Dominion War. And when we see, you know, how Deep Space Nine and the Next Generation movies went to that darker uniform from the brightly colored TNG uniforms.
Which is my favorite. My two favorite uniforms are the TNG movie / DS9 uniforms, which I always call the DS9 uniforms because that's where they get used the most. Mm-hmm. And also, as you said, the maroon jackets from The Wrath of Khan. Those are my two favorite uniforms. And the progression is nice. And I think in Enterprise, they did a really nice job of creating uniforms that feel more like uniforms to us today that you might actually wear, knowing that you need to move around, of course. But
well, they look like a good in-between uniform.
Right. That's what I mean.
Between our time now and what would become, you know, Star Trek in the future.
And they also show how, like, there's a beginning to the color coding of the divisions and such.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out quite nicely. And it leads nicely to the TOS uniforms, TNG and such. The things I notice in the infographic here is that, I mean, they're off on colors a little bit. Like the DS9 uniforms, by the time DS9 got to using the dark gray uniforms, the blue had already shifted to teal. And they're showing it as like purely like a TNG style bright blue that Beverly used to wear. But overall, it's a nice thing. Some of the characters are kind of chunky a little bit on here.
Yeah.
But it's a nice progression.
It was a nice style, though. I think, you know, because I've seen, you know, over the years, and you can definitely find them online, the different... I don't know, the models that they use for the uniforms and just the blank mannequin look that they have. And so this is on par with some of the better ones by far. And I don't know if I would have included Seven of Nine as a uniform or T'Pol as a uniform. I don't think cat suit fits as, you know, the uniform category, but.
Well, T'Pol's uniform here in this diagram, in this infographic, doesn't really work for me. There are other things that she wore that I would have chosen right here. The Seven of Nine one, it's funny that, and also the fact that they chose kind of like a lavender color for it.
Yeah,
so there were other things they could do. The you're talking about the different styles they've used in the past. The ones they use in the Star Trek Encyclopedia are terrible. Those illustrations are just are really bad. These are much, much nicer, especially the male figures here. The styling of the male figures is actually really nice. I don't like the chunky female with hands on the hips styling that they did.
Right.
But the other ones are quite nice. So it's pretty nice. So we'll put a link to this in the show notes if you want to go check it out. It's another one of those nice infographics that we've been seeing come out periodically from different designers these days. And this is over at Design Taxi. Okay, one last item in news today, Ben. I wanted to ask you what you thought about this. Now, this is completely a publication trying to make a story where one does not exist. If you watched the 28-second video, of which 14 seconds is the logo of the publication coming onto the screen, this was an interview with Total Film, the UK publication, and they were talking to Roberto Orsi and Harrison Ford about Ender's Game, which Harrison Ford is in. And the person doing the interview asked Orsi, can you tell us where you are with Star Trek 3? Can you give us an update on that? And Orsi says, I've just started thinking about it and trying to steal as many good ideas as I can, including from this man, talking about Ford sitting next to him. And then Orsi looks at Ford and says, will you be in that? And Harrison looks over at him with kind of a smirk on his face and says, sure. And that's the end of it. And so then all the headlines come out that Harrison Ford says he'll be in the next Star Trek movie, which they're kind of just joking with each other. He's like, yeah, sure, whatever. But let's just pretend Harrison Ford is going to be in the next Star Trek movie. What do you think he would do in a Star Trek movie?
Oh, wow. Would he be the rugged old admiral? Or would he be, would we finally get Harry Mudd and have a serious take on Harcourt Fenton Mudd and in a Star Trek movie? This could be the opportunity. The gritty Harry
Mudd.
That's
an interesting idea. Yeah.
Because he's a smuggler. He's got some history with that. You know, he knows how to play a smuggler. But now, you know, we do Star Trek 3 Mudd's Women with starring Harrison Ford. And when they call him Harry, sure, you know, Harrison, Harry, it works.
Harrison Mudd.
Exactly. And so I've heard the rumors of, what was it, Shatner will be old Luke Skywalker in the next Star Wars movie directed by J.J. So this ties in. We can just do a one-for-one swap. I think we're getting the better deal out of that, you know, getting Harrison Ford to kind of bring, you know, his Oscar-winning chops into the Star Trek universe. So my dream of a Harry Mudd movie could come true.
I like this a lot. I really, really did not want to see Harry Mudd played by Jack Black, as the rumors were, you know, a couple of years ago.
No, it has to be because the universe has changed. When Nero came through, the universe changed. We've got a very English con in the second movie, so now we can have a very heroic-looking, you know, rugged Harry Mudd in the next movie.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. And as we know from the comics, in the Abrams verse, Harry Mudd has a half-Bajoran daughter. So I'd like to know I think that would be perfect for Harrison Ford as well.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to write a letter, you know, to start off, dear JJ, sorry about the 12 previous letters. I really didn't mean that. but now that you're talking to Harrison Ford, here are some ideas. I'll pull out my typewriter and start putting something together.
That's very good. And the other thing that I've learned from this conversation is that in the future timeline of Star Wars, Luke Skywalker retires from being a Jedi and becomes the spokesperson for Galactic Priceline.
This is the deal you're looking for.
That's perfect. Perfect. All right, well, that's all we have in news today. But Ben, before we jump into the feature, we're going to be joined by Mike and Max from Commentary Trek Stars to talk about For the Uniform. Let's tell everyone about our sponsor, Squarespace. Now, we talk about Squarespace every week. They are the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it very simple for you to create a blog, a website, an online portfolio, or, of course, an online store with the really fantastic commerce feature that they've come out with. And that's where they've teamed up with Stripe. And commerce is now available in quite a few countries: the US, UK, Canada, Australia, Belgium, France, Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Spain. And it allows you to sell both digital and physical products online. Now, Ben, in the other side of the room...
The other side of the room.
You were telling me that you are planning to move some of your WordPress sites over to Squarespace, and you were interested in knowing how easy that is to do. And, of course, you can actually import your WordPress sites over to Squarespace using the import feature. What kind of features are you looking for in Squarespace? What got you interested?
Well, one of the things I keep hearing everyone everywhere talk about how easy it is just to deal with Squarespace from the ground up. And so my only concern is I've put so much work into my WordPress sites, but they really get complicated, and you have to, to really be able to dig in, and you have to know CSS, and you have to just constantly be tinkering with the plugins and all the little things. And at the end of the day, it's just, and I have to search out a plugin for e-commerce. I have, because I'm trying to sell books on my site. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just easier to just not even do it, which is, you know, missing sales. Yeah. And so my big concern was how hard it would be to just roll that over and have to recreate it in Squarespace. But now I'm finding out I could just export that out and start, you know, with what, you know, all the work I've already done will just carry over to Squarespace.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's very easy. You export from WordPress, and then in your admin interface on Squarespace, there is an option for importing, and you just go there and you just tell it it's a WordPress site and you import it. It'll bring it right in. And then, of course, you can use the tools within Squarespace to tweak it, you know, if anything doesn't turn out exactly the way you want it to. And but it's very, very easy to do. And it's great. Yeah, if you want to sell books online, this will be great, because I've had to set up shops for clients in the past and get, you know, third-party e-commerce stuff and integrate it, and it's really tough. But because Squarespace has integrated Stripe into the platform, there's just a 30-second merchant sign-up. It's really quick. You get instant approval. It doesn't require any paperwork, and you can begin selling items or receiving money in just a matter of minutes. And it handles full tax and shipping rules by region for you as well. There is a store admin interface that helps you manage all your outstanding orders. You can resend customer update emails. You can print your packing slips, and all this from a single interface. And for those of you out there who already have existing inventories in, let's say, Shopify or Big Cartel, you can move those right over to Squarespace as well, those existing inventories, in just a few clicks. And so very, very easy way. And also, I'm not sure what kind of books you want to sell, Ben, but let's say if you want to sell products that are on Amazon as well. This doesn't relate to Stripe itself, but this relates to your Amazon associate account, because many people have those, and that's how they you know, raise funds for their sites and all as well. There's actually an Amazon product block in Squarespace that you just drag down onto the page. You type the name of the book or CD, or, you know, it could be anything that's on Amazon, or you can put the identifying number that Amazon has. It'll pull it up, and let's say it's a book. You put that in, you just click it. It drops it on your page. Not only does it do that, but it pulls the artwork in for you automatically. It can put a buy button there for you as well. Pricing information, it's all just instant. So there's like really no footwork that you have to do other than just knowing what item it is you want to sell. It's really fantastic.
This seems a lot easier than the way that I'm doing things now.
It's a whole lot easier. You mentioned plugins as well, and I do deal with some WordPress sites for clients. And one thing I love about Squarespace is that I never have to worry about extensions becoming out of date or incompatible when you update the system. It's because it's all part of the same platform. They handle all that for you. If it's in there, it's going to work. You don't have to worry about it. And if you ever do run into a problem, they have the absolute best support I've ever seen anywhere. They're available 24/7, and they are on the ball. If you contact them, they're right back in touch with you, and they stay with you until the problem is solved. So a really fantastic support. The best way to try this, and this will be great for you too as well, Ben, is just go sign up for a free trial. You can try it free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. You have access to all the tools in Squarespace during that time. And then when you sign up, it's just $8 per month, $16 for unlimited, or for the commerce package, $24 per month, which is an absolutely great deal because you're getting CMS, you're getting hosting, and you're getting the e-commerce. And mm-hmm. you just pay a small fee to Stripe as you would with any credit card processing. You don't pay anything to Squarespace for each item or transaction that you make in your store. And then when you decide to sign up after that trial, you can use our offer code TREK10 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase. And if you choose the annual plan, you can also get a free custom domain registration as well. So go check it out. Go to squarespace.com and find out for yourself how great the tools are. I know you're going to love it. And don't forget to use our offer code TREK10. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM and helping us bring the Ready Room to you every week.
Lair of seeing the old fox around. He keeps himself to himself. He's staying close to the ground. All's well, profit here. 10 years ago, we kind of played the cassette. I let her go for a song, it's time we settled the debt. This will cost him dear. What do I care? Oh yes, you're wrong. Give me my share, finish the job. You shut your mouth, give me your hand.
We knew from the start that Benjamin Sisko had a temper. After all, he punched Q in the face in the 6th episode of the series. But if you really make Sisko mad, I mean really mad, he'll chase you down in a broken ship and try to punch a holographic projection of you. And that's what happened to Michael Eddington when he decided to escalate the Maquis Starfleet conflict in For the Uniform. And today we're going to talk about this episode. And to help us do that, we have with us our commentary Trek Stars crew, Mike Schindler and Max Hegel. Hey, Mike and Max, how are you guys?
Doing okay. How are you?
Yeah, we're good.
Doing well. Okay, glad to have you back on the show again. So we're going to jump into For the Uniform, which is one of my favorite DS9 episodes, and because we get to see what happens when you piss off the Sisko in this case. So let's start with Max. Why don't you kick us off in the discussion here of For the Uniform? And, you know, I mean, the basic premise of this as it starts out before it gets so personal is that whole Maquis conflict and the Maquis with their beef with the Cardassians, with the Federation, and of course, Eddington becoming a traitor.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those weird things where a Star Trek newcomer would kind of find the concept rather bizarre, since it does initiate with a whole bunch of treaty negotiations that are being disputed by various parties. And it's all kind of inside, but the long and short of it is that there's somebody who really feels offended by the betrayal of governments, and Eddington is a sympathizer with these people, and he takes some rather extreme measures. And this episode features Sisko taking exceptionally extreme measures to fight them in order to maintain the treaty, which is considered to be more important than the individuals. It's a rather complicated storyline. And it's one of those episodes of Deep Space Nine where they don't really have a clear right or wrong. It's pretty clear that what Sisko's doing is at least potentially really immoral. But it's really hard to come down and say, I disagree with that. And I mean, at best you can say his solution worked. It's probably a terrible solution, but it might be the best one available.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting thing, and it's one of the things that Deep Space Nine does really well.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that science fiction can do really well from time to time.
Yeah, one thing we'll talk about later on is the fact that this episode was written by Peter Allen Fields, who also wrote the story for In the Pale Moonlight, and it kind of leads in, you know, it sets up Sisko on that path towards what he does in the Pale Moonlight as well. But the tactics used here are definitely controversial. I don't know. Mike, what are your first thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I like this episode a lot, too. I think that
the idea of bringing back Eddington is cool, and also the idea of bringing back the Maquis is cool. You know, I always thought it was funny how the Maquis were created essentially to launch Voyager, yeah. but they were fully exploited in Deep Space Nine, whereas Voyager just forgot about them after like 2 weeks. But I also do like sort of the moral gray area, you know, the idea that, you know, in Star Trek, we're often used to the good guys being always right. And here, you know, especially the captains, and here we have Sisko, who is doing something which is morally questionable, you know, and you have to sort of look at his motives and his tactics and wonder whether or not what he's doing actually is the right thing. And the fact that the show doesn't really give a clear answer to that, I think, is pretty cool. You know, Eddington makes some really good points. And I like that.
Yeah, that's, you know, I hear some people who say they really like Eddington and they really sympathize with him. And they think that what Sisko did was just terrible. And you could not forgive a Starfleet captain for doing those things. And I think that it is one of those cases where you can see Eddington's position. You can see Sisko's position. Personally, as we'll talk about later, I don't know. I feel like Eddington kind of crossed a line he shouldn't have crossed, but. Ben, what about you? What are your first thoughts on this?
Well, this was, you know, the first time I've watched the episode since it probably originally aired or shortly, you know, thereafter in rerun season. And so to get ready for this, I went ahead and went back and watched the other Eddington episode for the cause, just so I could get a fuller, you know, memory of the situation. And it brings up, you know, one of the things that has bothered me about Star Trek for a long time is Earth as a paradise.
Right.
And, you know, why would you ever want to leave paradise type thing? And, you know, and Eddington and the Maquis aren't part of that paradise. They're out on the fringe. They're having, you know, to make, their lives out there. And they've basically, you know, if you go back to TNG, they were basically just, well, the Cardassian War's over. And we're just going to, you know, you're in that DMZ now. And they just threw him to the wolves, basically. So, you know, I think there's a lot of good backstory with Maquis. I think they could have been developed fuller and not just wrapped up in a tidy bow when the whole Dominion thing took off. And we had to get rid of that situation. But Eddington, I mean, he's definitely an idealist. And it was interesting to kind of look back and see this, and maybe this was where the Star Trek captains stopped being so nice, mm-hmm. was around this era, because if you look at some of the later Star Trek works, I mean, going all the way into the TNG movies, when we have, you know, rogue admirals all of a sudden and prime directive, you know, we'll bend it to what we need, mm-hmm. type thing. Here's Sisko, you know, definitely going out on his own, doing his own thing. And it's not that perfect, no conflict world that Gene Roddenberry talked about early on.
Yeah. What do you guys think? One thing I wanted to ask you about is early in this episode, Eddington, you know, talking about the fact that they have been left behind in the DMZ like this. He says to Sisko that their quarrel is with the Cardassians, not the Federation. And when he said that, I just did a double take. Really? Because I almost feel like their quarrel is with the Federation even more so than the Cardassians. Because, I mean, the Cardassians are their enemy to start with, so they're going to try to push them away. But they're fighting back against the Federation in a way like the Bajorans were fighting back against the Cardassians. They're really pushing back against the Federation. I feel like the Maquis have a bigger quarrel with the Federation itself, because the Federation are the people who actually ceded their worlds to Cardassia and left them in that situation. Do you agree with that? Or do you agree with Eddington that their quarrel isn't with the Federation?
No, I think it makes sense that they would be... their quarrel would be more with the Federation, mm-hmm. than anyone else, because they're the ones who are supposed to be looking out for them. That's their people, and the fact that they
essentially left them out to fend for themselves, you know, or sacrifice their homes for the greater good. That's what they have the problem with, you know, or that's who they should have the problem with, if you ask me.
Well, maybe, I mean, I can see being much more emotionally disturbed by the Federation's actions, because it's more of a personal betrayal. But, I mean, it makes a kind of sense to be, you know, upset with the Federation for being essentially left out to dry. But the Federation isn't really a solid enemy. Like, you can't actually say, I hate what they're doing. You could essentially say, I really hate what they're not doing, which is a really hard thing to get really profoundly upset about and then shoot things at. So I could see them being essentially begrudgingly not violently opposed to the Federation.
So in the case of Eddington, this just becomes a personal vendetta against Sisko. Do you see him as using Sisko as the embodiment of the Federation, or is it just like man-to-man personal with Eddington and Sisko?
I think it's a lot more personal for Sisko than it is for Eddington, but I would say that it's personal for both. Mm-hmm. I think Eddington, if anything, is more cool-headed, and he's using Sisko's hot-headedness against him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really? Because I would say Eddington's kind of... He's like not personifying Sisko in like a real way. He's sort of seeing him as an abstraction, which is why he calls him Valjean. I mean, he's like, no, not Valjean. The other way around.
Javert,
that's it. Yeah. He can't see Sisko as who he is. He's like personified him as the Federation. I think Sisko sees it as personal. And it sort of inverts over time. Like at the end, they sort of like change places. But early on, it starts with Sisko being very personally offended, and then later on not really knowing how to live with that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Well, see, I mean, I see Eddington, though, is really deep into this fantasy almost of his, where, you know, he's the good guy, and you know, he's like deep into this fiction of comparing this to Les Mis, that it's just, I mean, the whole thing with he is Jean Valjean in his mind. Yeah. He's standing up for the little guy. And he's wrongly accused. He's, you know, pure, where Sisko is the big bad, and you know, eventually Sisko owns it and becomes the villain. But for this, I think it's almost like almost Quixotic type thing, where, you know, he's imagined this monster of the Federation, and he's tilting at his windmills, just to tie up all kinds of old French stuff. But it's just almost like a fantasy land. It's like, I want to say I read somewhere where it was The Secret Life of Walter Mitty type thing, where it's just, he's got these fantasies of, well, the Federation is pursuing me, and, you know, and I am the big hero. You're really only a big spike for Sisko because of the personal connection. Everyone else in the Federation, you're just another rogue officer that joined the Maquis. That it's like, big deal. You know, we got another one. We got to deal with him. So for...
Well, he's definitely caught up in the fantasy thing with Les Mis, because he actually compares using a biological weapon against an entire planet with stealing a loaf of bread in a conversation that he has towards the end with Sisko. So he's completely caught up in this fantasy.
Well, he's mythologized the entire scenario to really at certain points, a level that is absurd, not just on like a personal psychological level, but on like a dramatic, I'm watching a TV show level, where as a viewer, I have a hard time buying this guy using Javert in a conversation with Sisko. Like, yeah, that's not crazy. I'm totally being reasonable, and I'm really obsessive. And I, as an audience member, am going, I don't care how crazy you are as a terrorist, you are not going to call, like, the CIA Javert if they come and bust down your door, because that's nuts. And that's a that's a really hard thing for me to buy. So, like when he does that, I have to, like, as a viewer, in order to maintain the reality, I have to say, like, he's just kind of screwing around. He's saying that Sisko is like an empty suit. He's playing this role for the theatricality of it. He's doing the Batman thing. He's using theatricality in order to get into the opponent's heads. I have to do that as a viewer, because if he's really thinking that, he's beyond reasonable.
Well, see, one thing I think comes into play is how literate, apparently, all Starfleet officers are. I mean, these guys are all well-read with, you know, 800-plus years of literature at their fingers. And it's, I don't know, it maybe this is a symptom of it, where, you know, they live in such a paradise that they have the time to study the literature, to have these philosophical debates. So when something like this comes up out in deep space, they're kind of ill-equipped to deal with it on a realistic level. So they make that connection and that comparison.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always thought the same thing. Like, you know, like there's the whole thing in First Contact with Moby Dick, you know, and she's like, oh, actually, I haven't read it. And it's like, that's the first time that someone has ever said that on Star Trek. But
she was from the past. I guess that's what happens when your characters. Though, that's the thing. Yeah.
I know. That's true. Yeah. I guess that's what happens when your characters are written by a bunch of writers. Huh?
Or it's a realistic depiction of the near future where we no longer have bookstores. Because that seems entirely plausible.
That's
but in
very
the near
plausible.
Future, it's just going to be hard to get a copy of Moby Dick.
That's right.
Well, no, it'll
you
be
might be able to get
your,
it on tape, maybe.
Yeah, but what about in the 24th century?
In the 24th century...
Does borders make a comeback?
I think that in the 24th century, like the lifestyle that they depict is one of, like, I basically have nothing to do all day. Like, it's an entire, like, galaxy full of, like, executive managers where they don't actually do anything with their actual hands. They sit around at board meetings and make decisions, and the computer does all the work. So, like, I believe them as being people who sit around and read old, ancient, highly praised books all the time. And and that makes sense to me. I buy that. I mean, like, that would certainly be my lifestyle if I had, like, that level of freedom. I would stay in my office all day, you know, reading old books that I always thought would be a cool thing to read. I mean, like, I've never read War and Peace. That's a classic book that I've never got around to reading. But, like, I keep saying, like, it's on the shelf. I bought it. I bought it a bunch of years ago. I keep looking at it thinking... Man, if I just lived in the 24th century and didn't have to deal with any Maquis guys, I would totally be reading that right now.
I think the problem is that in the 24th century, Space Kindle has a very restrictive policy. You can only download your books.
Oh, DRM?
Yeah, you can only download
That's
your books
terrible,
to
man.
Two pads. And so what happens is, you know, like one pad gets destroyed in a battle that you had with the Cardassians, and then you lose the other pad, and, you know, you loan it to Harry Kim or somebody, and they never give it back. And then he probably got killed with it, actually. And if it was Harry, and then you can't download your books anymore, I think is the problem. Did you guys also think when Dax is talking to Sisko and Dax says, I can't stand Victor Hugo, I was just expecting Dax to say something like, she went out with him when she was a because she has that thing in Trials and Tribulations about Dr. McCoy and his hands. And yeah. I was just thinking, oh, maybe Dax knew Victor Hugo. Oh, no, she just thinks his heroines are two-dimensional.
When I was watching Deep Space Nine most recently, it occurred to me for the first time that, like, Dax is alive now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right now, Dax is doing something. I mean, in Star Trek reality, and, like, I'm trying to picture it. I'm trying to picture, like, whatever Dax host is kicking around these days. And it's just, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit in my brain. I cannot picture Dax off in some place, possibly flying near Earth. It just doesn't make sense.
No. Yeah, she's probably...
It's kind of absurd.
Yeah, she's tailgating at Ole Miss or something.
Yeah. That's a really weird go-to, but fine.
Well, no, because she was apparently at Ole Miss when Dr. McCoy was there. And that's how she knows about his hands. And unfortunately, we didn't get the details of that story. But
that's like 200 years from now. Oh, really? There's a book?
There's a short story which details her encounter with Dr. McCoy. I think it's one of the first season 8 books.
But does it detail why she really knows about his hands? That's what I'm seeing.
Let's hope so.
What we're going at here is this family friendly, or does he have to go to the special part of the bookstore to get this book? And if so, I'm totally going to get that.
Yeah.
Not on Kindle, because I don't want the Ferengi taking that from me from sometime in the future. I want to have a hard copy.
But while we're talking about Dax and Sisko here, this has one of the great scenes in DS9 for me, which is when you don't piss off the Sisko, because you really get to see Benjamin's temper here when he's punching the bag. And he has the line, and anyone, if you listen to the Orb, you have gotten to hear Matthew repeat this line with full gusto. But there is the part where he says, is he a changeling? No. Is he a being with 7 lifetimes of experience? No. Is he a wormhole alien? No. He's just a man like me, and he beat me. I'm not gonna say it with spit flying on my screen the way Matthew did on the Orb, but it's another one of those cases where I feel like, you know, people talk about crazy Avery and how he is at cons these days and such, but he's just such the perfect actor for the role of Sisko. And to portray a captain in the situation that you have to be in order to be the head of Deep Space Nine.
Well, he's a weird actor. He's kind of like Shatner in that he's very stylized.
Yeah.
And like I kept on thinking during this episode, kind of like, I can't imagine that the way that he's saying this dialogue is the way that the dialogue was written. You know, I kept on thinking, like, this isn't how I would say that line, but I guess it works.
Or, you know,
that particular scene. Yeah. That particular scene, I think, is a little weird, because while he's saying those things, in between each one, he does that little, like, 1-2 combination punch thing. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of distracting, because it gets to be sort of like this weird gimmicky thing.
But for me, it works with Sisko.
He's a crazy actor.
If someone else were doing it, I might feel that way. But with Sisko, it really feels like Sisko to me.
Yeah. He's a crazy actor. Yeah. I mean, there's that guy, Evan Satoff. He writes for Badass Digest.
Yeah.
And he was recently doing a first-time watch of Deep Space Nine. And he kept on talking about how he was in love with Avery Brooks's performance, even though he wasn't sure whether or not he was actually a good actor.
It sounds so like him.
It does. I can totally
classic
see that.
Evan. that this episode has a lot of weird things. That scene, to me, and I was watching that recently, this was like a few weeks ago, that I watched this not knowing we were going to do this. And during that scene, I was like, how is this not a Ron Moore episode? This whole thing feels like BSG. Like, every scene in the episode feels like BSG. So say we all. Someone even says good hunting. The captain goes and punches a punching bag for a scene. It's crazy BSG. It's so much like it. I feel like Ron Moore must have seen that and gone, that's solid. That's solid. I'm going to use all this. Give me it just
on a weekly basis.
Yeah, literally. This is going to be like the basis for a new show. It's going to be called Space Station something, and there's going to be some dudes. Going to have a bunch of people walking around in people's heads. Someone's going to hear music from far away.
But, you know, I mean, like knowing like Sisko's preferences and everything like that, I don't think that he'd be punching a punching bag. I think that he would be taking batting practice. I think he would be working out his aggression on a 9-inch ball.
That's a good point. Yeah.
9-inch? It's a 9-inch ball?
It's 9 inches.
So you measure around the diameter of the ball?
It's the circumference.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
Anyway.
I went to 2D.
The other thing I like about this scene, though, is that Benjamin and Jadzia, I guess I should say Sisko and Dax together, because what I like is that you can feel, for me, the fact that these two people have known each other for a long time, that it's not just Jadzia, the science officer on the space station, but there's this connection that it's almost like he's talking to Curzon here. And even the way Terry Farrell plays Jadzia, when they have scenes like this together, I feel like there is that connection, like they're old friends. Like, I can't see anyone else on the station being in there with him while he's punching this and having that conversation with him.
Yeah, this isn't the first time she's held the bag for him. I mean, that was the sense that I got. That, you know, this is something, you know, when he's had a really bad, you know, day or something's gone wrong, they've gone to the gym, and Curzon, back in the day, held the bag while Sisko, you know, did a few punches and worked it out. And the big thing I got from this scene, though, is that Sisko does not like to lose.
Right.
I mean, that is a major character trait, I guess, that he has. I mean, nobody likes to lose, but he definitely doesn't deal with it well.
Which makes you wonder why he's wearing a Cubs hat in the first episode of the show. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, come on.
Oh, no. Because after the series in 2018, the Cubs really picked back up. And, it was like winning seasons up until the London Kings took it away from them in 2032. So just
to... Okay.
I want to play some Sudoku.
No, hopefully by the 24th century, my Cubbies have won. Please, for the love of God.
They totally win the Super Bowl next year.
Well, we know that they make it to the World Series in 2015, but they lose. Oh, no, they do.
No,
they win the World Series in 2015.
They beat Miami.
Against Miami, which is apparently the actual joke,
yes.
Which I didn't know. And I still don't really understand. Don't explain it. Never explain it.
I love the fact that Max referred to the World Series as the Super Bowl, though, because that just ties into the whole Trek FM sports ball. We just, you know,
that was my hypothesis, that if they just refocused, they might actually be really successful.
Max is not a big sports fan.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination.
No, I am a very large sports enemy.
There you go.
You sports is your Sisko. Sports is Sisko to your Eddington, basically, right?
Sports is my Javert.
Okay, there we go.
Is? Let's go with is. I'm going to stick with is.
All right.
Singular, yeah.
While we're talking about different elements this episode, and you know, you said there's a lot of weird stuff in this episode, and it does have this odd feeling to it. One thing I really want to talk about is the holographic communicator and the creative communications methods in this episode. We actually have two of them, which Starfleet decided not to employ widely, which is the holographic communicator and the shouting Ferengi. This is the case where Nog's big ears got him the job. And the whole time that I'm watching him shout orders down to engineering, and I like, even towards the end of the episode, he's like, engineering, bridge. I'm like, Nog, they get it. You've been shouting orders to them all this time. You're the only person on the ship shouting orders. They know it's the bridge. It's like an open link between the bridge and engineering. But the idea that you've got someone off in the corner repeating everything that the captain says down to engineering, plus you have everyone on the bridge announcing every single little thing that they do because they have to fly the ship on manual, essentially. And then there's the holographic communicator, which I never liked. I don't know. Did you like the concept of a holographic communicator?
No. It felt incredibly cheesy.
Yeah.
It felt exactly like what it was, which is like, how do we solve the problem of people talking to computer screens?
Exactly.
Oh, let's have them here. But they felt so there. I don't know if it was the lighting or what. I don't know. I got the impression that they were just standing there on the set talking to these people.
Yeah. That's not
Maybe
what they
because
were doing.
That's exactly what it was.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I don't know.
Blow my mind.
But I did not buy that for a second. That was ridiculous. So was the Nog thing. But this was incredibly ridiculous. I am so glad that everyone involved, everyone who saw this episode from a creative standpoint, was like, that didn't work, and never used it again.
Going into it, creatively, they thought that this was a good idea. And then, of course, after they saw how it came off, they never went back to it. But apparently, Ronald D. Moore has a big issue with view screens. And part of that is in First Contact, when he and Brandon Braga replaced the view screen on the Enterprise with a holographic screen, which I thought actually worked well in First Contact because, you know, on a movie screen, and it wasn't crazy like having someone stand on the bridge. It just felt like there was some depth to what they were looking at. Mike, you're shaking your head. You don't like the First Contact one either.
Well, they've always kind of been played fast and loose with those, because on Next Gen, you would see people.
It's always been.
You would see like different camera angles, and you would see the dude in the view screen, like the side of his face. And when I was watching that, sometimes they would do that, and every time I was like, what?
Well, it's that.
Is there like a lenticular lens on that thing?
It was supposed to be three-dimensional on the D as well.
Oh, it was supposed to be, right. But of course, they never made any attempt to pull it off on screen. It was just because it's a TV budget. So,
well, no, they did.
They were supposed to have that depth. I mean, that sense of depth. And like Max is saying, that if you look at a lot of the, especially first season TNG, they did a lot of shots because I can remember the episode.
Well, the Ferengi close-ups.
The Ferengi.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd have a Ferengi almost a side view with Picard in the foreground there as they're talking, and it was almost like they were trying to give you that sense of depth, and it was this huge concave screen that almost like a wraparound screen on the front of the bridge, so you could get that.
But I'll have to go back and really watch carefully, but I personally never really felt on TNG. I need to see Damon Togg up close. Is it Damon Togg in that scene, or is that another Ferengi? But
it could be, because I think he was the one that was just, you know, right there, just big face, before we found out that they were about 5 foot tall and...
and they had leather like, and whips and fur and stuff, So,
But
in First Contact, I really felt what they were trying to do more. And on the series, it never really... I mean, I know technologically that was the concept of the view screen in universe, but I never felt it. But at any rate, what Ronald D. Moore said here was that he thinks it's so absurd that in the 24th century, they have holodeck technology that allows them to recreate the Roman Empire, but everybody talks to each other on television monitors. And Ira Stephen Baer also said that view screen scenes are always difficult to pull off, and the longer they go on, the more boring they are. And having a character talk to someone on a view screen is very distancing. And so I really agree with them all creatively in what they're saying here. But then when you actually see it in the episode, like you said, Mike, it just feels cheesy, right? Because the other thing, Gary Hutzel in the visual effects department said that, you know, the idea is amazing. It's to create an amazing 3D image, but since TV is a 2D medium, it's hard to show that it's 3D. So you do just end up with another actor standing inside a little box, glowing box on the bridge. And I'm thinking, what a waste of space on the bridge of a starship. You've got this box on the floor that's only used when someone's image is supposed to be projected there.
Right. And they do the thing where they're like, oh, well, someone else needs to have one of these things too. And they're like, oh, he just installed it.
Right.
Oh, look at that. This is so weird. Oh, Eddington's like, hey, it's a good thing that we were able to install one of these on our, you know, broke-ass ship that we just stole from some dude, you know?
Yeah, it's one when I first watched this, I thought nothing of it. I just thought, oh, is this a thing they're doing now? They're introducing this? And then like halfway through the episode, I'm like, oh no, they did it specifically for this.
Yeah.
I don't like it. What? It's kind of silly. But if they had done it gradually, just little bits here and there over time, gradually building up sort of like the holographic interface that they use for more than just talking to people on other ships, then you could easily get to that point where you could have a dude on the bridge who's not technically there, and it would work fine. But they did it all at once.
Yeah.
They info-dumped the audience with holographic projectors in the bridge so that you could talk to the person on the other ship. Really, that's fascinating. Hey, we have a plot to deal with right now. Maybe we should get back to that. It's really awkward.
And did we kind of get a fuller concept of this with Voyager? Because with the holo projectors that were, you know, located throughout the ship to support the doctor, and I forget the ship that had the Federation ship that was much newer than the Voyager had them all throughout the holo projectors all throughout the ship.
Right.
Well, hopefully that would support this type of communication. And anytime they had communiques back with Barclay and the Admiral, you know, Admiral Paris back on Earth, you would have the, you know, via the holodeck or via the holoprojectors. So it was kind of this whole thing, but without the big box on the floor.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, don't step there. That's the holoprojector.
Well,
now we have it more integrated.
It could get messy, though, because imagine that, let's say Riker's dad, he has the time zones, intergalactic time zones mixed up, and he wants to call his son, and he just projects himself right into Riker's bedroom, you know, at like, you know, midnight, 1 a.m.,
which is never safe.
Yeah.
Had to be Riker. Who knows what he's got going on in there?
So it could get messy if you could project yourself just anywhere on the ship.
I would be very on board with an adoption of more holographic technology in next gen reality. I mean, it seems kind of crazy to me that people set their terminals and, you know, push buttons. I mean, like, why not, like, if a Klingon sits at your helm, show the interface in Klingon? Why, that would make sense. Mm-hmm. There should be more integration of this amazing technology into their lives. But you wouldn't do it there. That wouldn't be the first step you take.
Well, see, the only problem I ever had with the view screens in all the years of Star Trek is this is the 23rd and 24th century, and they still have analog static on the view screens when things go wrong.
Right.
It's you know, there's Data, quick, get upstairs. He's got to twist the antenna, adjust the rabbit ears or whatever. It
takes like a roll of foil with him. Yeah.
Kind of right. Like if I get hit by a missile and it says like video one, just black screen, green text. There's a lot of different ways it could go wrong.
They're old school guys. You know, they still, when they watch movies, it's on 35 millimeter. When they're in their quarters, they use laser discs. They're just one of those, or a bunch of those people who, you know, are anti-digital. You know, everything that's digital is bad. They want the life, the soul of the person to come
through.
Well,
maybe during the Third World War, you know, we were still recovering from the Eugenics War. And we lost a lot of our digital technology during that time. Or perhaps it's like on BSG where there's some way to, like how the Galactica isn't networked. The Enterprise can't use digital video transmission because it's too easy to break into.
I think what happened is that Starfleet Command is in San Francisco. But of course, Picard being an English Frenchman, he had PAL installed all over the Enterprise, and those NTSC signals won't come in on the D.
NTSC? Come on, bro. We're way past. No, I think there's a solid in-universe argument for it, because they do have a lot of analog technology. The transporter, it's got digital technology, but it's also got to be an analog system. And so, I mean, like, they can't copy holograms. They can't just make two doctors. There's a lot of analog stuff built into the core of their technology. And every time they piggyback a signal on another signal, they're talking about waveforms, not digital packets of data. Like, they have some sort of, a next level awareness of analog technologies that we can't really embrace yet. We see just waveforms of nonsense. I mean, they could see our audio waveforms and go like, oh yeah, I know how to solve these problems in a second, because they're aware of things that we aren't.
It's actually, it's a really good point, Max, because I was reading an article the other day about different types of next generation computing technology. And of course, everyone's heard about quantum computers that they're trying to build. But this other group is trying to build
an analog technology.
Right, it's a computer that uses it's almost like running blood through the computer. I think actually IBM is designing this computer. But one thing they said,
or vampires,
it could be that, yes, Transylvanian business machines. but what they were saying though is that even the best computers that we have now, of course, and even looking at quantum stuff, our brains are much more efficient. And they were saying that in this design, to take the next step in computing power would mean a move back towards analog and away from digital. So it actually is a concept that seems likely.
That's not like a new revolutionary thing. We've known for a long time that we get something more with analog technology than we do with digital. And there are going to be, it's going to wax and wane for probably as long as we build things that tick. But obviously the D is doing a lot of analog stuff. So presumably it's pretty mainstream using some sort of analog transmissions.
Worf likes to listen to his Klingon opera on vinyl. All
yeah,
that
he,
stuff,
he likes
right?
the little yeah. the static mm-hmm. in it. Yeah, it just feels mm-hmm. more real that way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. recorded on blood wax, some sort of crazy Klingon nonsense.
So, Max, one thing you said earlier was that we've got a plot. Maybe we should get on to that. And the thing about the holographic communicator here, that while I don't like the technology the way that it is presented, I do feel yeah. like it was necessary for this one episode, because all the exchanges, particularly between Eddington and Sisko, I just can't see that stuff happening on a view screen. It really needed to be them looking at each other and being that close to each other for it to work. So it just feels like it's a unique thing in this one episode where this technology makes sense in order for the plot to resonate, because the standoff between them and the whole Valjean Javert thing would, I feel, have been lost if they were just communicating on a view screen the whole time. Do you agree, or is that just me?
I agree with that in principle. I just think that as a viewer, I was too aware that it was something specifically adopted for these purposes. Mm. And while it's happening, I'm thinking, like, this wouldn't work in Star Trek 2. I mean, like, you can't have a dude walking around the bridge because he's got to stand awkwardly in one place so the projector can project him. Mm-hmm. I mean, what would happen if he, like, decided to push some buttons on a terminal while he was having this conversation? Like, would his hand just vanish? That'd be pretty suspicious. I'd be like, where's your hand go? He's gone.
Let me
bring
see
it back
hands.
In there so I can see where your hand's at.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kept on thinking of, like, the Kirk and Khan face-offs in Star Trek 2, and how,
yeah.
you know, that really wasn't a big deal.
And there was a lot of pacing, there. A lot of walking around.
Right.
And it worked really... So, I mean, that's a fantastic... The idea that you can't do, like, view screen drama is crazy. Like, Star Trek mm-hmm. 2 says, no, all that's nonsense. If the characters are strong, it reads, mm-hmm. totally reads, you guys.
Right.
Don't bother with holographic projectors. It's totally silly. A message from 1982 to the Deep Space Nine writers that they weren't paying attention to for this week.
Now, something we have to take in consideration in universe is that the AI developed for the Starfleet monitors and the cameras that receive the images, which can do the dramatic cuts and the framing for each shot to make the captain look as good as possible and as powerful as possible.
Yeah. Well, it's...
I think my thinking is the crew of 1,000 or whatever it is, somewhere in there, there's a technical director at a switcher, you know, at a Grass Valley switcher or whatever, who's just, you know, doing this. You know, he's the creative guy. He's the AV guy.
But the Maquis surely ship, they just have like a local TV dude
right.
like volunteers mm-hmm. his weekends to do this.
Right. Yeah.
Right. He's like a public access editor.
I think so. He's mm-hmm. the same guy that used to direct Wayne's World, right?
Yeah.
Well, he would produce Wayne's World.
Well, produce,
World.
Yes.
Wayne's
right.
World didn't have a director.
That's
technically.
True. Yeah.
Just to get all nerdy about Wayne's World.
I
expanded universe, maybe. I don't know. I haven't read the novels.
I don't know. We'll ask Tom Paris. You know, he's really up on all that 80s, 90s American culture.
I'm sure he would know.
I think that what happened is Starfleet incorporated all that Metron technology into these holographic communication devices. That's how you get all the different cool camera angles that you wouldn't expect
Explain
to be
that
possible.
Reference.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking
Explain
about.
Explain the reference,
either,
Chris.
Sorry.
Oh, we're
from
we're
Arena.
Lost.
That's
Bro.
How, you know, they watched the fight with the Gorn from the Enterprise. With
Got
all the
it.
Yes,
Got
yes.
it.
Thank
you.
Thank you. I'm ashamed that I don't know that. I should be ashamed of myself.
Really,
I just,
really
okay.
you're the one that should have known that with the Gorn
I know.
Business card. And
I know.
Everything.
I'm, but I, you know,
I'm
when
embarrassed
I see Gorn,
for you,
I just,
not me.
I don't see it to me. All, when I see Gorn, that's all I
just
see.
Just the Gorn.
You know,
Gorn carries that episode, right? Mm-hmm. Or as my wife said when she walked in and Arena was on, why is there an alligator wearing a tunic?
Oh, man. That's crazy.
Because
he's a crocodile.
It's awesome.
Because it's awesome. That's right. What did you guys think, really quick here, Nog shouting the orders back and forth? I was just imagining if this were normal operations and every single episode of Star Trek... Imagine watching that episode with an officer in the corner who has to shout orders back and forth between the bridge, engineering, and other parts of the ship, including cetacean ops, of course.
You know, where the dolphins work.
I was a little confused by this. When they originally said that Nog would be relaying the messages, I originally thought, okay, Nog is going to have to be running back
and forth between
the bridge and engineering.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's like the messenger of the watch, where it's like, okay, Nog, tell engineering to do this. And then he takes off running and he climbs down the ladders and, you know, runs into the, you know, O'Brien, we need to do this. And then runs back to the bridge. But instead, he's just got the little cell phone on the corner there, just like, hey, engineering, bridge, do this. Why couldn't the captain do that? Just set it on like two-way, you know, set it to duplex, put it off on the captain's chair there and just let the cat, because, you know, Avery Brooks can talk pretty loud.
I could just picture Nog running back up to the bridge. He's out of breath. And then Sisko says, more speed. And then he, oh, gosh. And then he runs, it slides back on ladders. More speed. And then he climbs back up.
He runs back up with a note that just says, okay.
Okay. Yes.
It really doesn't make any sense. First off, why can't they just use their regular communicators as if they were out and about, you know?
The actual communicators,
anywhere?
Yeah.
Well they explained
the things that they all are.
Well, that was...
They're not working?
No. There was interference from all the exposed EM conduits, EMP conduits
okay,
or something.
Okay. Is that what it was? I wasn't paying attention to their
O'Brien
explanation.
O'Brien did cover that. But again, this whatever this thing that Nog has that keeps him from running and getting some much-needed exercise, why can't they have a couple of those?
Yeah,
you can't set that to like, I mean, like right now, like in the room that I'm in with the microphone that I'm using, it picks up everything. I mean, right now, my wife is sitting here watching the Packers game, exercising the most restraint I've ever seen by not shouting at the TV so that you guys won't hear her, you know? I mean, you don't think that microphone that Nog had would be able to pick up everyone on the bridge, you know? It was definitely their version of, I mean, they were trying to come up with something which was super low tech, mm-hmm. you know?
You guys, if we're going to nitpick a technology problem in this episode, I don't think this is
right.
the one to go at.
Okay, you're right.
Well, it's I mean, flying the ship on manual, I mean...
Okay, that's the other thing.
You're still doing it.
Yeah.
You're still just pushing the buttons. You're just saying that you're doing it now.
Right.
Pushing the blue button. Bleep. Like... Pushing the red button.
It's sticking a little bit. Okay, there it goes. It's okay now.
Did you guys push that blue button? Because I didn't hear confirmation that blue button was pushed.
I know the ship is turning, but you didn't tell me that you turned the ship. So
nobody tells me that they pushed it. I'm going to push this blue button right now. Somebody better tell me.
Well,
that's a ridiculous scenario.
As they're going toward the pylon, as they're leaving DS9, it's like, the blue button. Come on, guys. Blue.
I like that scene, too, because the Defiant is heading towards the pylon, and then Dax is getting it set up, and now, like, it's almost like she was seeing how close she could get before she said now. Then she says now, and then the ship just flips sideways. I'm thinking, like, can't you be a little more gentle, Jadzia? Can you just kind of roll us into turn?
Well, he specifically said, don't do any quick turns, or you could end up doing a barrel roll. So it's like,
yes.
Why did you then specifically do it?
She has a flair for the dramatic. She likes to have fun. How many times can she do that? She's like, now's my chance to do this. This would be cool.
Done it hundreds of times. She's probably doing it right now.
In her latest
way
host.
Out in whatever part of the galaxy she's in right now.
Right.
Having sex with someone.
All right, well, let's jump back to the actual meat of the story as we move through the events in the story. And I wanted to talk about Eddington's tactics. So as we get further along and he goes and he actually poisons the atmosphere of the planet, the Cardassian colony is there. And, of course, there's an interesting point here of what both he is doing and what Sisko is doing in poisoning these atmospheres because... They're rendering this planet inhabitable to Cardassians, and they're rendering this planet inhabitable to humans. But just focusing on Eddington himself, what do you guys think about his tactics? Because I think, and this is what I always think when people tell me that they kind of sympathize with Eddington and what he does here. Up to this point, I mean, the fight against Sisko is one thing, but once he takes that step, crossing that line of using biological weapons against an entire planet and poisoning the atmosphere, and yes, people can start evacuating, but we're talking about hours here, so not everyone is going to be able to run to a ship and get off a planet, and so people are going to be killed in this, I would think, or at least made very, very sick from this. Do you feel
him? And they have to be told by a specific Ferengi because of all the interference.
That's right. That's right.
It's going to be really hard to get the word out.
What are your thoughts on Eddington's tactics taking this drastic step?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, he's, you know, crossing a line too. I guess the difference is that we expect him to cross this line. And we don't expect Sisko to cross the line. So when Sisko does, it's like, whoa, whoa, wait, what? You know, but with Eddington, we're going to cut him a lot more slack because he's supposed to be the bad guy. And, you know, the idea that people died, I think you're looking at it a bit too practically. You know, the fact that they didn't specify, like, he's killing people, I think.
You guys, stop focusing on the people that died.
I think it's supposed to read that he didn't, you know? Otherwise, they would have been like, you know, that's going to kill people, you know, but that wasn't the point that they're trying to make. It's kind of like, I think it's pretty similar to the destruction of Metropolis in Man of Steel, you know, spoilers, but, you know, that's not what they were focusing on. So I think
Sisko,
like,
Sisko destroyed
though,
Metropolis in Man of Steel.
Spoilers. Right. So even though that may be what happened, that's not the point that they were trying to make. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
What you're saying is that because nobody talked about specific, like, body counts or probable body counts, the implication is that there probably weren't. I mean, like, logically, you could say it's entirely possible people died.
Right.
But also
there would
it's
have
entirely
been
possible no one died, because it is kind of a long-term thing. I mean, what, it would take hours at least? There's enough time to transport a bunch of things. They've got lots of stuff. I think that that's fine. Now, the issue isn't, like, how many people died. The issue is it's a drastic thing to do, because it does sort of, like, you, like, no matter what you do, you're tipping the balance of power in some direction in a very significant way, and it isn't a political way, it's a very aggressive way. So it's more about, like, essentially making a decision for a whole planet, and that's pretty aggressive.
Yeah. See, I was wondering, I mean, after watching this, though, why hadn't anyone done it before? If Cardassia and the Federation both consider the Maquis to be a problem, that you just fly in and zap these planets with the biogenic weapons, and it's like, all right, we're good. And I know the Federation couldn't officially do it because, you know, it's, well, we're the good guys or whatever, but you could turn a blind eye while Cardassia does it, and you solve your Maquis problem. And we've seen admirals, you know, many times after this who are willing to take steps like that, who are willing to make this kind of decision. You know, it's like, wow, it took this long to come up with this solution. It's, you know, guys, come on.
The I don't know. That's kind of a dangerous bullet to pull out.
Yeah, that's what I think.
You can fire that at a lot of things in a lot of episodes.
Yeah.
But why don't they do this every week? Yeah. It's kind of a problem. I mean, they've done a million things. Yeah, we can transport you through shields. It's totally hard, and it'll take 30 seconds of explanation, but I can totally transport you through some shields. And they never do it again. It happens all the time. So I think they didn't do it because nobody thought of it. There's too many ideas out there. Somebody was like, what if we grow a bunch of bananas to track them to the bananas because they're so delicious and nutritious? There's too many different things.
I think it's...
That's my explanation for why they didn't do
the
it.
Fact
because
that,
you have to come up with one.
Yeah, I think that the fact that... And again, yeah, they don't talk about body count. And in fact, the implication at the end is that no one was killed, I guess. But...
Well, it seemed to wrap up kind of nicely, though. It was like, well, you know, we messed up this Cardassian planet, and they messed up this human planet, and we'll just switch, and everybody's calling it even.
Right.
And everybody's happy.
And that's the justification for saying that what Sisko did was okay, because you could say, well, a Starfleet captain poisoning the atmosphere of a planet is a line that you can never imagine a Starfleet officer crossing. But then you say, well, what Sisko really did is he poisoned these planets, this group of worlds that were occupied by humans, so that the humans would have to leave, but Cardassians could move back there. And Eddington poisoned this group of worlds so that the Cardassians would have to leave, but then the humans could go back there. And so it was almost like it was a very bizarre solution to the problem of saying, okay, we put all these worlds on the wrong sides, but now we're just going to switch. Because he actually says in his captain's log at the end that the colonists who were forced to abandon their homes will make new lives for themselves on the planets their counterparts evacuated. The balance in the region will be restored, though the situation remains far from stable. But it's like, this is a solution to restoring balance, and the solution is born out of a conflict, a personal conflict between two men. And they're using biological weapons, which I think, like Ben, you said, why didn't they just do this in the past? I think that Starfleet knows they have the ability, they have the technology to do it, and the Cardassians have the ability and the technology to do it. But it's like here on Earth, it's something like chemical weapons or biological weapons or nuclear weapons. It's just something that we have them, but we don't use them. When they are used, they're used by rogue regimes or terrorists. They're not used by official governments. And that's...
Except when they totally are used by big governments, they do it real quiet. Like,
well, it happens, right. Yeah, I mean, it happens. But like ethically, it's something that the general population, we view it as a line that you don't cross. These are weapons that you don't use. And I think that's why, even though it worked out this way, it's something that they had never considered as a solution.
Yeah. Mutually assured, really irritating travel time because of how long it would take to get places.
It's mutually assured resettlement. That's what happened here.
Yeah. Mutually assured significant annoyance. That would be very upsetting.
So are you guys shocked by Sisko's actions, or do you feel that he was justified in taking the actions that he took?
I was kind of shocked by them. You know, I guess in the end it all worked out. I don't know. The one thing about it, you know, I liked the ambiguous nature of it. I was surprised that he went that far, but I guess I didn't like the last scene that he had with Dax, where she was like, "Oh, so this will happen? Oh, you didn't get permission from Starfleet to do that? Oh, whoops, And then they play it off as like this little cutesy thing, like, "Okay, well, yeah, all is right," and blah blah blah. That shouldn't have been there. That kind of ruined it for me. Because I like the fact that, you know, there isn't a clear answer as to whether or not he's doing the right thing. And that sort of undercut that.
I'm not sure if it does. Does it? I don't think so. I never got that.
I think it's the tone more than anything that does
I think it weakens the... I mean, it doesn't ruin the episode for me, but I do... I know what you're saying, that I feel like it sort of weakens what happened a little bit, because it is kind of blown off as like, aha, we did this. I think that what Dax says, I think it fits her character perfectly, that is Jadzia. And she says, sometimes I like it when the bad guy wins. But I mean, obviously Sisko didn't get approval from Starfleet to do this. So she really doesn't even need to ask the question in the first place. So it is kind of a cutesy moment that's thrown at the end. It's maybe a little bit like the laugh scene at the end of a TOS, of every TOS episode, almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes the note is wrong.
It's actually really similar to the last scene in Enemy Within.
Oh, God, don't bring that up.
I'm just saying.
Taking it to a dark place. We were talking about genocide. Now you're going to make it weird.
But, you know, she's like, you know, oh, sometimes I like it when the bad guy wins. But no, I mean, like, if she would have delivered that line differently, because maybe Sisko was the bad guy here, you know, and maybe, yeah, sometimes we do like it when the bad guy wins. But what about the fact that sometimes Sisko can be the bad guy? You know, that's the thing.
I think that's why I actually don't have a problem with the tone of it. I think that they do actually, I think part of that moment is like, yeah, our side sucks and we all kind of know it. but there really isn't a good alternative. So, yeah, we have to be the bad guys here. And I don't have a problem with that as the final note. I think that makes a lot of sense. They did absolutely pick the lesser of two evils. And
but the way she delivers the line is like, oh, you're the bad guy, just like, you know, Javert was the bad guy in that book, you know? Oh, I like it when the bad guy wins, you know? Whereas it's like, no, Sisko could very well have been the bad guy in that situation.
I think he was the bad guy in that situation.
But that's not the way it plays, the way that the...
I don't know. That's how it played to me. I don't know. Maybe I didn't get that impression. I thought the final scene was them saying, yeah, we're the bad guys.
No, it was like, yeah, we're the bad guys. It was like
it's
that.
It's all tone.
Anyway.
If you're going to be the bad guy, you should feel a little bad about it, maybe. Because, I mean, I didn't see Eddington feeling he was the bad guy in this.
Oh,
he was doing what he believed in.
Yeah.
Where I think Sisko seemed to me, you know, he definitely started to white whale on this and go off the deep end about, you know, getting Eddington and stopping Eddington. That, I mean, it got a little, you know, Ahab-ish. That it's like, okay, you know, Ben, you need to kind of settle down a little bit, you know, take a breath. You're about to zap a whole planet with, you know, biogenic weapons here. And just the hesitation that the bridge crew, I mean, you know, Worf is, you know, happy to fire a photon torpedo at anybody. But when, you know, when Worf hesitates hitting the fire button, you know, there's some deep, you know, it's like, did you really just tell me to,
well,
seriously?
And Kira also, I mean, Kira looks at Sisko like he's out of his mind. And remember that she was basically a terrorist growing up fighting against the Cardassians. And even she thinks this is, we can't do that.
Before I agree with anything, I'd just like to say that Ben just turned two things from Moby Dick into a verb and an adjective, and that was awesome. White whaling, Ahab-ish, those are solid. Those need to go in the dictionary. But I got the impression that this episode was all about accepting the role of the villain. And I think Eddington accepted the role of the villain. And so did Sisko. And they both thought that they were fighting for something bigger than, like, the momentary nobility of their actions. And I don't think that the implication is that either one was right. They were on two different sides of a stupid situation, and they both dealt with it.
Yeah.
Sisko was upset that he was beaten, not that Eddington did something wrong. Mm-hmm.
That's, yeah, definitely at the beginning. One thing that, a last point to talk about how this leads to the next thing, the other story that was written, as I mentioned at the beginning, by Peter Allen Fields was In the Pale Moonlight. And how do you guys feel about the decision that Sisko makes at the end of this episode to poison the planets? And, I mean, we can talk about whether Sisko felt anything afterwards, and, you know, the scene with Jadzia and all. I kind of feel like after this, and we don't get to see it, of course, but Sisko, he seems like he would have gone back to his quarters and really thought about what he had done and whether it was right or wrong, or whether he, as he says at the end of In the Pale Moonlight, you know, I think I can live with it. But this sort of paves the way to In the Pale Moonlight, because it does set up for us the idea that Sisko is willing to make decisions that we really can't see any of our other Starfleet captains making in order to do something that he feels has to be done, even if it's something that we would think is ethically questionable.
He definitely, yeah, there's definitely sort of a structure to it. Deep Space Nine sort of flirted with it. It's kind of odd that they are so sort of close together in both Peter Allen Fields, but they are the darkest moments in Sisko's history of actions. But it's also part of the show. The show regularly deals with essentially more protracted Kobayashi Maru scenarios, mm-hmm. where at the end of the day, somebody has to die.
Right. Yeah, I don't really see it so much as being like a progression in the character as I do just sort of like, yeah, the same writer wanting to push the idea further himself. You know, he kind of dipped his toes in the water here, and then within the Pale Moonlight, he, you know, just dove in, and I don't think that there one necessarily led to another in terms of the character, or that that was the intention. I think he was just like, okay, let's do this now again, but for real.
But at the same time, I mean, it is a show, and you know, we can actually go over it piece by piece, and there. And when you analyze it from that perspective, when you analyze like Sisko's actions or the actions of the Deep Space Nine people, like there is sort of a clear arc of Sisko gradually doing increasingly questionable things and gradually making really less Starfleet decisions over time. I mean, like the one that like struck me as a viewer when it first happened was when he was like, yeah, I guess I'll be the emissary, whatever. It's cool. I'll be a prophet. That's fine. That's not a conflict of interest at all. And, like, this seemed small by comparison, to me at least. I think, you know, playing a role in a religion is a little bit crazy. Even C-3PO wouldn't do that. And he would totally poison an atmosphere. And so, like, the gradual, like, progression of Sisko from, like, does everything by the book to, I have a book. It's somewhere around here. I'll check it sometime. And, like, you know, Quark gradually becoming really, really nice, and Odo becoming gradually more humanized and feeling more connected. They all have an arc. Sisko's arc is essentially, I'm going to do what got to be done, even if it gets some people killed.
Definitely for me shows, it's a glimpse into Sisko's character, I guess. I lean more towards Max's explanation here of Sisko's arc. I think, Max, you summed it up better than we've ever summed it up on Trek FM before, that Sisko's got to do what got to be done. So
that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been talking about this for more than an hour now, so let's wrap up with our final thoughts. So, Mike, what are your final thoughts on For the Uniform?
I would say that For the Uniform is a very good episode. I like the way that they built on both Eddington and the Maquis in general. I like the moral ambiguity which the episode presents. And on the whole, I guess I would give it 3.5 Klingon opera vinyl records.
That's pretty good. Because it's analog, okay. So it automatically gets you like an extra point in the rating system for being analog.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Max?
It's a great episode. I mean, like, I can talk about the problems in it, like the holographic interface thing, but otherwise, I think it's really solid, and it's another example of how well the Maquis was used by Deep Space Nine, thereby making Voyager look silly. So I would definitely give it only one holographic screen display, which works the other way around from usual, because 4 is terrible. 0 is perfect.
Great. How about you, Ben?
I really liked a lot of the issues they brought up in this, and it was nice to see a continuation of the Eddington storyline. And it was really interesting to see how dark Sisko could go, and to see, you know, that starting in this episode. And I think I would give it probably 3.5 shouting Ferengis out of 5.
Very good. Well, for me, like I said at the beginning, this is one of my favorite episodes just because it is ambiguous. You know, Sisko's faced with a situation where he has to make a decision that's not by the book Starfleet. And, you know, the reason I like DS9 is because it does give us a more real world view of things. Sometimes the things that Starfleet captains do in Star Trek seem just a little bit too easy, too by the book for me. And of course, Les Miserables is one of my favorite musicals as well. So I kind of like the use of that story here, although I do think they overdo it a little bit at the point when Eddington just continuously refers to Sisko as Javert. It gets to be a little bit much, but It's a nice thing there. And I'm going to give this something that we failed to mention somehow to this point in the episode. I'm going to give it a Malinche, because Sisko loved saying Malinche in this episode over and over and over and over and over. So I give this a Malinche, a USS Malinche.
It's pretty good.
I dig that.
All right. So before we go, Mike and Max, tell everyone where people can find you guys on the network. Well, and elsewhere, not even on the network, everywhere on the interwebs, I mean.
Okay. Well, you can find us on our website, commentarytrackstars.com, where we do a commentary track stars off topic with our friend Brandon. And that's where we talk about general stuff, movie stuff, sometimes not movie stuff. You never know.
Also lieutenant stuff.
Lieutenant stuff, yeah. And I don't even know what that means. And you can also find us on trek.fm doing commentary Trek Stars. And I know I've been saying this everywhere for like weeks now, but this week is when our interview with Mark Cushman and John D.F. Black and Mary Black is released. So if you're a fan of the original series, be sure to check that out.
If you're not a fan of the original series, it's still hella fun.
Yeah. Also check it out.
So. Very good. All right. Well, thanks guys for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Good times.
Wow, Chris, it was really good being back and to come back to such a great discussion with the guys. I really had a lot of fun today. So thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, I'm glad you could join us. And I know you always enjoy discussing DS9, so I always try to get you on for DS9 week as well. It was fun, and I knew Mike and Max would bring something interesting to this discussion, because if you've listened to Commentary Trek Stars, you know that Mike and Max often have very different views of the books and the movies and the stories that they discuss, but they also have a really good way of working together to discuss those points. So I thought this would be a great panel today, and I think it was.
They had some very good discussion points, and it was nice to see not everyone agreeing, much like on this episode of DS9 we talked about.
Exactly. Definitely so. Well, as much fun as it was talking about angry Sisko and Javert and Valjean, it's not the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this week, so here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
Time travel and alternate realities.
And then you have everybody else on the Defiant that we, you know, obviously don't know very well, but they all have somebody that's going to be affected. And then you think, too, oh goodness, the whole entire Dominion War would have been affected if they hadn't gone back.
Earl Grey.
Episodes we love to defend.
In the observation lounge, and he accidentally calls him number one, and then they look at each other like, is he going to figure it out? I'm thinking, what do the Ferengi know? They don't know anything. They're not like, wait, let me look that up. Wait, that means something that Captain Picard calls his first. No, they don't know that.
The Ready Room.
Relics.
In the day, I asked Ron about it, and he said, we just screwed up, I screwed up, producer screwed up, Mike and Rick, and it wouldn't be Andre then, it would have been Narain as the science advisor. It's like, nobody caught it.
To the journey!
5-episode marathon.
Yeah, with Aisha Tyler and Jerry Ryan, she talked about how when she signed up and actually signed the contract to become 7 of 9, she'd never seen the show before, but she watched an episode of Star Trek Voyager as she went home that night and was aired, but apparently it was like the worst episode ever. She literally cried that night because she's like, what on earth did I do?
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Ronald D. Moore recap.
So you're saying that you wish Star Trek was BSG?
No.
Say for the record that you wish Star Trek had never existed and that Battlestar Galactica was the thing instead.
Warp 5.
Enterprise Season 1 Blu-rays.
Towards the end of that particular documentary, Brannon expresses that he had been also feeling quite dejected and burnt out at the end of the first season, which makes me wonder, did he really have the energy? Was it kind of only just hanging in there?
Trek News and Views.
Halloween Treks.
Played the murdering crazy person who has psychic visions and can communicate with ghosts.
It was kind of a similar character to the one on Voyager, right?
No.
No? Okay.
Literary Treks.
Demons of Erin Darkness.
Well, what's interesting about it is that, you know, Kira, you know, her gods haven't cast her out. You know, her people have. And it's a lot the same way of, you know, Luther and his 95 Theses and being kicked out of the Catholic Church and all of that happening. Because what Kira has brought to her people is kind of a reformation
And introducing our TOS show, Standard Orbit.
James Tiberius Kirk.
No, Star Trek 4, I mean, aside from the bookend stuff, I don't really know how much Kirk grows there. It's kind of a standalone story in a lot of ways.
He learns about whales and how it's bad to hunt any animal to extinction.
Which I guess is an important lesson to learn.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in many places, including iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox Zoom. You can stream or download from the website. Many, many ways for you to get the shows, so check them all out, and you can find it all at trek.fm/pd for podcast directory. All right. Ben, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on For the Uniform or anything we talked about in news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail from any page on the website. Just look for the tab that says Send Voicemail. Click that, and you can use your webcam's microphone to record the message and upload it to us from the page. I'd also like to remind everyone about questions from the fleet. If you have questions about Star Trek, and it can be anything, any question about Star Trek that you would like for us to answer here on the Ready Room, you can send that in to us on the website at trek.fm/contact. There is an option for questions from the fleet, so just choose that and, you know, let us know what you want us to answer about Star Trek, and we'll do that here on the Ready Room. Also, there's one more place where you can join into discussion, not only with us, but with other listeners, and that's in our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Ready Room. There's one for all the different series and other topics, and there will be a thread there for this show. So go check that out if you'd like to join in a bigger discussion. Now, in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and you'll always find us on Twitter tweeting away about Star Trek under username Trek FM. Now, Ben, what if people want to find you personally, find out what's going on with you, ask you questions about Star Trek or Doctor Who or whatever they want to talk about? Where should they go?
Well, the listeners can always find me on Twitter at Reality Amuck, Reality AMUCK. You can find me hanging around occasionally at the Dork Trek site at dorktrek.com or on Jenny Zell and my podcast, Doctor Who, it's playingdoctorpodcast.com. So we're all around the internets.
Excellent. So many ways to catch Ben if you want to chat with Ben. If you want to find me, you'll find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And on the network, you'll find me on several other shows. You'll find me on Literary Treks with Matthew Rushing, where we talk about Star Trek books and comics, and also we interview authors. We have a great interview this week with Una McCormick about her book In the Fall series. We had David R. George III on a couple of weeks ago, and we'll be having all of the authors in the fall line as the series goes on. You'll also find me on The Orb with Matthew, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. So if you enjoyed today's discussion, you'll definitely want to check out The Orb. And you'll also find me with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. So check out all those shows for various other Trek topics. Also, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsors for this week's show. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, or, as we discussed, with the Stripe feature, the commerce feature, an online store. It's the easiest way you're going to find anywhere to set up an online shop. So go check it out. Create your own space today. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial, and then use offer code TREK10 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase. And don't forget to choose the annual plan to get your free custom domain registration as well. And also, go support Zoe, the world's first personal voice companion. This just really is a very cool device. And you can find out more about this Star Trek comm badge-like technology and support their Kickstarter campaign by visiting zoe.me/trekfm. That's zoe.me/trekfm. And remember to include the Trek FM portion of the URL when you visit, so Zoe knows you heard about it here on Trek FM. Plus, you can help us continue to bring the Ready Room to you each week by getting your alien badges and art prints. These are original illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. You'll find them at trek.afilm/donate, and you can mix and match badges and art prints. There are different levels that you can choose from, and your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you each week, and we really appreciate your support of the network. Well, Ben, I'm going to go over, you know, Nog, his throat got dry, and so I have to relay messages down to engineering, so I'm going to be busy with that for the next few hours.
Wow. It's time to fire a couple of biogenic torpedoes into it, because the Ready Room is done.